Waging war on the body. What if compassion and aligning with the body's needs was the answer instead? My hope-filled musings. What if we replaced our all-out attack and statophobic approach to health with advocating for nurturing choices that rejuvenated the body? What would it be like to live in a world where another starvation diet and combative body battles were no longer in vogue? What if we could wake up to a world where health access was available without bias or marketing manipulation for every size, color, race, and body type? Could we then accomplish freedom from body shame, food fear, and diagnostic whack-a-mole? Then would we all be free to be who we really are? Sounds good. Unfortunately, this is not the case for healthcare today. Not yet, anyway. That's not to say that it won't be. Let's look at some of the background showing how we came to our current approach to health and body care. Only by analyzing our history, the failures along with the successes, can we move forward into something more inclusive and freeing. The first big body war. By 1970, cancer was the second leading cause of death, and something had to be done. The National Cancer Act of 1971, an amendment to the Public Health Service Act of 1944, was a governmental solution in the first official declaration of war on cancer by President Nixon. According to the National Cancer Institute, the NCI website, we have made some headway in the United States since then. Whereas worldwide cancer mortality rates are expected to increase, there's been a national decline in overall cancer deaths. There's been a drop of 13% between 2004 and 2015. Statistics from the NCI are based largely on the SEER program. SEER stands for Surveillance, Epidemiology, and End Result. The SEER program collects and publishes cancer incidence and survival data from population-based cancer registry that cover approximately 28% of the U.S. population. Reviewing the timeline of events in NCI history, programs based on prevention, wider screening, and research into initiatives such as precision medicine were more apparent in the later years of reported declines. Still, according to the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics, cancer remains the second leading cause of death, just beyond heart disease. In 1980, there were 416,509 deaths from malignant neoplasms out of 1,989,841 causes of death. In 2015, there were 595,930 out of 2,712,630 overall causes. This was stated in the 2016 40th report. More deaths, more people. 75 years of mortality in the United States reports, although the number of deaths increased over the 75 years, the risk of dying decreased. Interesting, the website states, reductions in death and death rates are often used as an indicator of success of public health initiatives to improve the health and well-being of the U.S. population, as well as to set national goals for reducing disparities in the burden of mortality across groups. Anti-tobacco campaigns, aid prevention programs, and cancer screening promotions all use lives saved as a measure of success. Statistics can get confusing, but let's just say the measurements aren't exactly perfect. So, what's my point? We've claimed war on cancer. There appears to be some success in alleviating death risk, but with more money, more years, and more research, we still have an increase in number of deaths. Furthermore, quality of life during and after conventional treatment is a factor for cancer care that doesn't usually get measured in mortality statistics. Some even say we may be barking up the wrong tree, trying to combat cancer without a true understanding of what it is. Although screening is assumed to be a factor in decline of death rates, there's a big controversy on the benefits of screening to save lives versus the potential harms of overdiagnoses. It appears to me that when we declare war on the body and its natural processes, we achieve minimal success at best with a high cost, emotional, physically, and financially. The current pandemic crisis. As we fight cancer and other diseases, we are engaged in another battle, one aimed at the body itself. We've declared a war on obesity, and we aren't gaining progress. In fact, the trends are rising. No matter how we twist the numbers and how many diet and exercise books enter the market, many recycled with flashy terms, we are losing. Although it may be uncool to use the word diet now, anti-aging fitness and health cultures, healthism, are gaining popularity with just as many rules and rigidity around body manipulation and food. This epidemic of fat shaming blames the victims, uses ineffective science, and participants usually end up worse off than when they started combat duty. What if you believe everything you believed about shrinking body size was wrong? We have waged a war on our bodies and its imbalances for too long. Our stigmatism and shaming of body shape starts early with negative health associations. Our medical and dietary remedies for weight loss as a solution are biased, restrictive, and based on ineffective science, which leaves the participants worse off, as I stated. We live in a world where fat is an F word and must be fought. The result is a fatophobic society obsessed with weight, food, and health, living in a diet culture driven by fear over choosing the next food that will either kill or cure you. Sadly, our obsession with overcoming obesity and achieving perfect health is diverting our lofty pursuits and true passions. Health was supposed to be a means of these, not the end point. Our disordered and distorted views on health morality is also contributing to feelings of inadequacy, decreased autonomy, and the unethical promotion of health practices. I wrote some excerpts from journals that detail three main concerns of this focus. One was the ethical aspects, the extent to which the public health war on obesity reflects the ethical values and principles of critical health promotion, a multimedia critical discourse analysis. The conclusion, health promotion researchers and practitioners engaged in weight-related public health initiatives should critically reflect on the extent to which they are consistent with the ethical aspects of critical health promotion practice. Two, the harms associated with this weight-centered health paradigm. The war on obesity, a social determinant of health states. Recent critiques of obesity prevention programs have highlighted the importance of focusing on environmental changes rather than individuals, due to the part that the risk of harmful consequences associated with individualistic victim-blaming approaches. Beyond this, there are suggestions that framing body weight as a source of health problems, known as weight-centered health paradigm, is in itself a harmful approach. The range of harms includes body dissatisfaction, dieting, disordered eating, discrimination, and death. Health promotion policies and programs that operate within the weight-centered paradigm have the potential to have a negative impact on the health and well-being of individuals and communities. Three, the ineffectiveness of fighting fat. The ineffectiveness and unintended consequences of the public health war on obesity. The abstract states, the public health war on obesity has had little impact on obesity prevalence and has resulted in unintended consequences. Its ineffectiveness have been attributed to 1. Heavy focus on individual-based approaches and lack of scaled-up societal environmental policies and programs. 2. Modest effects of interventions in reducing and preventing obesity at the population level. And 3. Inappropriate focus on weight rather than health. An unintended consequence of these policies and programs is excessive weight preoccupation among the population, which can lead to stigma, body dissatisfaction, dieting, disordered eating, and even death from the effects of extreme dieting, anorexia, and obesity surgery complications, or from suicide that results from weight-based bullying. Future public health approaches should A, avoid simplistic obesity messages that focus solely on individuals' responsibility for weight and health, B, focus on health outcomes rather than weight control, and C, address the complexity of obesity and target both individual level and system level determinants of health. The 2005 article, The Epidemiology of Overweight and Obesity, Public Health Crisis or Moral Panic, published in the International Journal of Epidemiology, states, in any case, the real question is whether these developments represent some sort of genuine health crisis. This is true only if crossing the threshold of BMI 25 or 30 is analogous to contracting a life-threatening disease. But this analogy holds only to the extent that overweight and obesity actually cause increased mortality. This is a problem because a recent study is BMI, a valid measure of obesity in postmenopausal women, just inferred the very measurement we are using as an association may in itself be inaccurate. Therefore, not only are the associations weak, the very measurement is questionable. Three viewpoints on health for health's sake. In a Medscape General Medicine article, End the War on Obesity, Make Peace with Your Patients, the author lists three main take-home points that may be a better solution to the supposed problem. One, weight has been greatly exaggerated as a health risk. Two, sustained weight loss is not a practical goal, nor is it established to improve health. Three, health improvement can result from improved health behaviors regardless of whether weight is lost. Last week I wrote the following in my blog, and it's worth highlighting here in reiteration. There are many health measurements that are the result of an effect, an accurate, or an assumed association with health, not a means to having it. In fact, obsessing over negative numbers could potentially be damaging one's well-being. I highlighted probably one of the best articles that summarized the concepts and controversy related to health at every size. It also highlights the research showing why weight isn't the health goal many think it is. Not everyone can be a size 0 or 2 like some authorities would think you can. However, everyone has the right to be healthy and take care of themselves with compassion and self-respect. Next week, I'm going to discuss how we are promoting disordered eating patterns and resultant health harms by obsession with weight loss, the famous starvation experiment that led to food preoccupation in a culture much like ours today, and the release of the American Pediatrics Association stigma experienced by children and adolescents with obesity in Pediatrics November 2017 journal edition. A healthy all-inclusive obsession. I've become even more focused on essential oils because they promote health and wellness of the body, mind, and spirit in an inclusive, unbiased way. Not only can they balance emotional health from trauma of body image shaming, they can also support the change of behavior for more nurturing choices for our well-being. I urge you to read all my other articles on healthism to get more of a background and to look at some of the positive actions we can take to support our wellness and well-being over focusing obsessively on our weight. Thanks for listening.